Okie dokie. So, well, I'm gonna figure out how do I get next slide. All right. That is the table of contents for today. So, first we're gonna talk a little bit about the digital, say like digital formation of materials is probably the best term to use. And then we're gonna check what kind of already digital materials there is, and then what kind of collection of digital material that's already exist ready to be used in a research. And then one important feature when you use digital materials in your research is the management of the digital research. And then finally, in the end, we speak a little bit about in a situation when you have some kind of materials that you would like to use, but that they are not already made in the digital form. So it's kind of how you can do it by yourself. All right. A little bit about the background of the how these documents have been started to be digitalized, and it really started really intensified and getting like more to be done in early 2000s, and those kind of organizations like archives, libraries, museums, and memory organizations were the, in a ahead, and they had a mostly materials they wanted to put in a digital form so that the research could be used them more easily. So also there's some individual materials like a private archives or something, and that kind of also wanted to be part of this, and but those are not very large part of the whole thing. But in the end, if you look at the materials what archives and libraries and museums are actually holding, it's really enormous, and because the material is so large, it also have a kind of really big potential doing research in a new kind of way. But like we did mention in a previous lecture, that the one challenge has been that those early 2000s digital materials were mostly digitized in the idea that humans will read it, so that the research will kind of download the materials and read them like a one by one. And now we are entering the era of machine reading, then we have to kind of rethink the digitalization process and kind of start all over. And one of the big issue about this redoing this mass digitalization is copyright legislation. And because the more we actually have digitized materials, the more we have realized that there's so much materials in it that cannot be used whatever, and it has to have a kind of rules of ethics and copyright and that kind of, so there might be a people's personal information there that cannot be public. But then if there's the 2000s kind of gave us the other kind of materials also, that are materials that are already digital, and like social media, games, and internet, and so research data can be collected like straight on in digital form. And also many organizations in administration kind of transformed themselves in a digital form and started to do an archive already digital materials. Are you gonna, Tanya, continue from here?
Yeah. So we are actually looking at digitization of documents a lot currently in different kinds of infrastructural development programs as well, because as Marco mentioned, even though we have huge amounts already of materials, older materials that are digitalized, we are in a place where often we have to re-digitalize them or somehow extend their use, make changes because of the technical forms, how they were digitized originally, were meant for human eyes only. So what does digitization kind of include? Some of you have perhaps worked with the digitalization of materials, so you might be familiar with this, but it's basically the conversion of material and analog data into digital form. So digitization has been very focused on textual material, but there's a lot of development going on for digitizing other types of data as well. For example, images, even buildings. Like on the last lecture, we showed an example of how 3D models of buildings are created to kind of conserve them, but also change them into a format where they can be studied differently in comparison to their material format. And digitization largely takes place in different kinds of what we called memory organizations or cultural heritage organizations, so archives and museums. And the aim is to preserve data so that they are kept for future generations as well in one format or another, but also the increased usability, the increased accessibility. Traditionally, researchers have been perhaps in very different situations, considering where they work from, what are the resources they have for traveling to archives and museums all over their countries or all over the world. So increased digitization gives access, it gives kind of a more democratic access to these materials in the best case scenario. Can we have the next slide, please? So Marco, if you can change.
Yep. So here you can see the whole chain of digitalization. It starts from the receiving the materials, and the next step is the preparation for them to be digitalized or conversation. So they might be sometimes if it's kind of books, especially printed sources or something like that, then you kind of have to break the book and cut the papers from it. And or if it's some other form of already paper documents, then you have to check it out if it's clean or so on. And the next step is scanning. So all the documents are being scanned, and sometimes they're also put in a microfilm, but mostly not anymore. But it's not done after scanning it. Actually, the big process is the post-producing and structural analysis. And then you have to all kind of check if the scanning was okay, and if there's some areas that it wasn't scanned, or you rather leave out some parts, and then when the material is done, then the last and probably most important thing is like making the material as accessible and also like stored in a way that it's easy to use.
So, as Marco described, originally it was just a matter of scanning the documents, and that was basically it of digitalization. So scanning documents and saving the files. And one of the reasons for doing this, of course, is also the preservation of the original. So especially in museums and libraries and with the older collections, the digitization of these documents is also, for research purposes, is also just because we don't want human touch on these documents. So we want as much handling of these documents and objects as possible to take place. But nowadays, it's, as we have mentioned often, about the machine readability of documents. What does it actually mean? It means that the image is not just left and archived as is, but it's also interpreted, translated as text. So kind of the text can be extracted from the documents. Sometimes images as well are extracted from the document. So we are talking about the specific technologies which are used to make the document more usable. So when we can also store these pages of text, not only as images, but also in text format, then we can do lots more with the data. We can do text searches. We can use the kind of text analysis methods that you use digital tools. For example, some that we are discussing next week and in the future weeks. Could we have the next slide? It has a bit more of a picture of the process, what happens. So once a document is scanned, it's scanned as an image file. And actually, when Marco mentioned microfilming, there's also like still sometimes, especially for a newspaper material, they're often first microfilmed and then the microfilms are scanned, because in some cases the quality can be even better. But after that, we have the text recognition part. And these two terms are the ones that you, if you are not familiar with before, you might want to remember. So OCR and HTR. So OCR is optical character recognition, and it's a method that is able to detect from the page printed words and letters. And it's currently a feature that's part of a pretty much any PDF reader you might use. So for example, on the university computers, if I remember correctly, it's called Exchange PDF reader. You can also just with a couple of clicks change any PDF document you have so that it's also readable. So you can OCR the document. And if you have image files, you can first transform them into PDF files in the program and then OCR, so do the character recognition. But then we also have a bit of a trickier case with especially older data and different kinds of scribbles in the margins, also with the printed data where we have handwritten text. Currently, we also have a method for this, so it's called handwritten text recognition. Marco might be better aware of the current development in this handwritten text recognition, but it's not quite yet at the same level as the OCR, but it's taken large steps lately. It's developed a lot. Transcribus software is something that, for example, historians used to use a lot. But I think, if I'm correct, Marco, that the pricing changed a bit lately. So this is why some archives in Finland, for example, are no longer using Transcribus, but have developed their own software for this. But for an individual researcher with a moderate amount of data, this Transcribus is still a fairly good option.
Yes, the Transcribus was a big European Union project to actually digitize these handwritten texts, which is quite large part of our materials what we have archived. So, but there's like a kind, little bit good news and bad news. Is that the good news is that it was previously used in a kind of a program based. Software so that you had to download it and do from that, but they upgraded it and now it works from the net browser, so it's more accessible and more easy to use for most of the users. But same time they changed that you can only do 500 pages free. So if you need to do more than 500 pages, you have to buy some credits from them, and that's is one reason. Like Tanya mentioned, that our national archives are not using it anymore, because even the price of the page is not that high, but if you start doing millions and millions of pages, then it is lots of money.
Yes. So, for example, also, it doesn't necessarily have to be very old material, but handwritten data like letters, diary material. Sometimes, for example, this research data collection that's taken place in the form of collecting people's memories or their views on different issues, that this might contain handwritten documents as well. So, for this purpose, this handwritten text recognition can be very, very useful for also for those using modern, more current new data. But let's look at some challenges, if you can
Yes.
have the next slide.
A kind of side note here that I have been kind of learning to use this transcriptable browser thing that it might maybe include in the next spring in this course. So who knows? We'll see.
Yes. So here is an example from internet meme. So we have a meme image with, first of all, there's a screenshot from an animated series. Some of you may recognize this. BoJack Horseman, I believe, was the series called. And there's text in the bottom of the image that says, because I have no self-control and I hate myself. So it's a line from the series, and this is a screen cap from the TV show. And above that, there's a line that's clearly added by the person created who has created the meme. So kind of what makes a meme, this kind of combination of kind of the commentary and the original image. And on the right side, you can see the text that has been optically recognized from that image. And you can see a very big difference in the quality in the two parts of text. So the text in the upper part of the image has been very precisely recognized. There's only one mistake. The word sitting, the last letter G, has for some reason been read as a percent sign, but otherwise it's perfect. There's no mistakes, no problems with the optical character recognition. But if you look at the lower part, you can see that there's almost there's and I, HA, that are somewhat reliable, but otherwise my as well. But practically, the message becomes unrecognizable. So you can probably guess some of the reasons why. The text in the bottom part of the image, it's very blurry. And behind, it's on top, layered on top of an image, which in itself has a lot of contrast. So there's strong differences between light and dark colors in the background, and the text is layered on top of that. So this is a real problem for the optical text recognition. If we can look at the next slide, we have there some of these challenges. So what we actually call this with OCR and HDR technologies, we call these problems noise. So it's sometimes this text recognition, it creates noise. So there are extra characters. There might be wrong characters, as with the G and the percent sign. There might be for example, in older text material paper documents, there might be some, you know, just some dirt on the paper, some ink drops, or you know, somebody spilled something on the original papers, and the text recognition might actually construe those as text. So they might think that, oh, this is, or recognize that as some kind of a symbol or letter or number. So that these things create noise, and this is somewhat unavoidable with certain kind of documents. So even though this text recognition is all the time progressing, you can never really completely get rid of noise. So these are some of the challenges. And even if we have in practice perfect quality of pristine documents, which do not have these problems, we might still have different kinds of text layout. So the more creative layouts we have, the more issues we might have with the text recognition. Typical problems have been tabular data. So if you have data in a table format, that might bring issues. And another common problem has been text columns. So documents where the text is not in a single column, but in several ones, like for example, in magazines and newspapers, it often is. But actually this problem is something that has been, has come far, the technology has come far. So nowadays we do have, OCR, systems that do understand columns and are able to read one column at a time from a single document. So these kinds of issues might arise, but I don't want you to get depressed by them or think that there are still issues. There are solutions to those things as well. It's just something you have to take into consideration. So, for example, if you are using data that is OCR'd or HTR'd, so it's been transformed into text from a scan or a PDF, you might want to and do want to check what kind of level, what kind of quality it has. So, for example, there might be that some particular words are time and time again misread, but in the same way. So if you then want to do kinds of things with the data, such as making word searches, for example. You might want to take this into consideration that if that particular word is often misspelled in the text recognition, then you also have to figure out how to search so that those documents come up as well. So this is just a very practical level issue. There also do exist solutions for making corrections. So there are currently developed these kinds of algorithms or programs that also can correct these OCR issues. So they might go through the data and make corrections with the best of the knowledge that what this word could actually be. Now here, this kind of algorithmic corrections, they work best usually in data that is formulated kind of in a correct formal language. So things like official documents or perhaps a news data or literature. But when you have the kind of data that has more colloquial language, so those, for example, slang words, it might be more difficult to use this kind of automated correction. But just know that these kinds of tools exist as well. So let's go forward, I think. So we talked now a bit about digitalized materials, but let's talk next about ready-to-use digital materials. So there's more and more data available online. So open data provided by governments who publish data openly, different governmental administrative entities. Of course, we have social media data, abundance of that. We have more and more medical data to use as well. Museums and other cultural heritage organizations are freely opening their data. And there are also archives of research data that are available online, either openly or through different kind of procedures. And this data is usually shared in this structured form. And what we mean by that is that it's kind of packaged in a way that there are certain kind of roles or tasks in the data and its components. So this usually means something like an XML file format where there's differentiations to what parts of the text have what kinds of roles. We'll get into more examples later on of this as well. So open data, as the name actually suggests, is the kind of data that's freely available to anyone and that can be digitally processed without a heavy digitization process. So in Finland, for example, public authorities and other public actors publish large amounts of data openly. And more research, us researchers and universities and research organizations are aiming to publish data openly as well. Either during a research project or after it has ended and after the project publications have been pushed out so that other researchers, other parties, other entities can also benefit from this data. And this is all part of a open science policies we have in place and are aiming for. So in some other courses related to your doctoral studies, you will actually hear more and be able to know more about this as well. We have some examples here of open data available. There are huge amounts around the world. So here is just a few links for you to find out more about open data in Finland. So there's the link to the English website related to this open public data in Finland. Then there's the European portal of open data, but I'm sure you will find many other examples when you once you start looking for from all over the world. These are just the ones most relevant locally. And as I mentioned, this is all part of our open science goals, which you can find out more about from our Open Science Center. And there's also a link for you to maybe after the lecture look at unless you are already familiar with it. Our Open Science Center also provides support and courses on how to open your data, how to take into consideration already in the beginning of your research process, in the data collection, the questions of how to open your data or how to use already existing open data.
A small side note here. I have a kind of learned that also for these research materials, but if you're looking at like a re literature, research literature, or maybe some older form of materials that like printed in source materials in the books or so on, you might find them actually in the different libraries. If you just go to the library websites, like from Sweden, Norway, or whatever European country or globally, just check, and they are not usually listed. I have never found one place where it's listed like where this open data is located, and so sometimes it just you have to be interested and just look for it, and most places where you can find them are like a different country national archives or national libraries and so on. Sometimes you just have to go in the web pages and find them.
Yes, that's a very good point that even though there's a lot of projects that are aiming to collect these things together in portals, for example, it's still not perfect. So you might have to go deep to different organizations' websites to find potential data. Now, one step towards making this data more usable, reachable, easier to find and use is linked data. So there's this goal of creating linked open data so that the different kinds of data sets that are owned or stored in different organizations could be linked together so that it might would be easier to find data related to one particular topic, for example, through this kind of linking system. There's an example here of Kulttuurisampo, Culture Sampo, which is a Finnish service that links collections of museums, archives, libraries, so these cultural heritage organizations in Finland. And here is a screenshot of the user interface of that. So Finnish culture on the semantic web 2.0. There are different ways here of searching and finding and organizing the data, either through traditional looking at the collections or through different kinds of search systems, even map-based searches. So this is just one example. In more examples can be found on the Linked Data Finland website, where there's, for example, a biography sample, parliamentary sample, and so forth. So these different thematic collections that link to the original open data sources. And this is part of a, again, a part of a more international work that's done to advance usability of linked data. So, what is actually in practice happening currently with many organizations is that they are developing the access and use for these materials, often in cooperation with universities, research institutes as well. So, the National Library of Finland, for example, has defined advancing the conditions for digital humanities, digital human sciences as one of their objectives in their digital policy. National Archives of Finland has been heavily investing in mass digitization of data. So these kind of efforts are taking place on a very large national scale in Finland, but also in several other countries.
So, where do you actually can find these already digitalized materials in Finland? There's two places, two main places. It's our national library, and if you go in this the homepage, you can find in the first place page already that you can start finding these different kind of materials. So you have to just enter your keywords or just browse in different kind of already collections and look for things. So this is one good place where you can start, and the other is our National Archives, and they have this Astia. It's a core place where you can start searching for what is archived and in digital form in our National Archives. And it's not that long ago. It's the that we our government decided that we have to start kind of a mass digitalization our National Archives, because and it started in 2020, and what is the goal? Is it the goal is kind of digitize all the state authority archives, and then kind of also kind of check it and destroy all the papers what has been already digitized, and this is in a huge task. And actually, they built a own building in Mikkeli, and they made this kind of big machine reading line so that they can actually do whole thing. And this is for example how much there's this, like a storage paper documents. It's like 135 shelf kilometers, and this is a project that no other state has kind of started yet. But I'm gonna pretty sure that it's gonna more countries will follow the this path. So where you can find these digitalized materials are, like archives, our national archives, and then most universities has their own archives. Not all, but some have their own. Like Helsinki University has some, and then many Swedish universities, and so on. And then also libraries. And then there's a small group of private archives, and that's a little bit not that sure that they actually have digitalized their thing, but sometimes you just have to ask, or if they don't have anything already digitalized, you might like do it for them, and so in that way you can actually get the access for the materials if you can do in favor of them. And then we have a lots of newspapers and magazines already digitized and storage in our archives and libraries.
Here are some more examples for you to look into. You can click on the links later when you get the slides, but just to remind you that there are several different places where you can start from. There are, of course, also research data archives. So archives that are storing data and sharing data that is purposefully collected for research purposes. So Tietoarkisto, that was earlier called Yhteiskuntatieteellinen Tietoarkisto in Tampere, so Finnish Social Sciences Data Archive, has an abundance of data, and they also have fairly nice database on their website where you can see what their collections entail. So often with these kinds of archives, even though you can't necessarily openly access everything right away, you can see online like what they have, and then consider if it's something that you might want to ask permission to use. Our own university has the YUX and digital repository, which archives, of course, theses and dissertations. It also archives scientific articles published by our researchers, so copies of those when possible. But there's also research data sets. So recently I checked, and there was currently 216 research data sets that could be found from the YUX archives. So even from very close by, you might find research data relevant to your interests. Couple of more examples. The Language Bank of Finland has a tremendous collection of research data. So they're listed on the Language Bank, Kielipankki website. You will find this data. There are those that are open and you're able to download them pretty much right away. There are those that you need permission for, and then there are those that might be pretty heavy on or difficult to get permission to use, but still it's possible. So you can look at it more closely there, but there's a wide variety, even though it's called the Language Bank. Which might indicate that this is of specific interest to linguists, so people in linguistic fields, which is of course true. They also have a lot of data relevant to other fields as well. So historical data, literary studies, researchers might find interesting data there. There are these lexical data sets and so forth. One big project that Finland has been a part of this Europe-wide and international cooperation is storing and opening up parliamentary speeches and parliamentary data all over the world. I mentioned the Sampo services earlier, so we have Parlamentti Sampo as well. But there are also similar kind of data sets open all over the world. So Finland, Then there's also EU level places like Brazil, Canada, Estonia, so forth, who have opened up these data sets so that they are usable all over the world. And one more thing that I would also add to the previous ones, now that I remember it, National Library. You might think that the National Library datasets are books and magazines, and there's a lot of them there, of course, but their digital collections also include online data, because in Finland, the National Library of Finland has the responsibility to collect digital culture as well. So, for example, a popular Finnish online discussion forum, Suomi24, there's a large data set of that discussion material available through the National Library. So keep in mind that it can be perhaps even surprising avenues that where you find relevant data. And I think this course is also a place where you can ask for help when needed. But then let's go on to collecting digital data yourself.
Like Tanya said, that our National Library has also something else than the magazines and books, but still the magazines are one of the most popular collections of data what they have. And they have made kind of ready some packages that you can actually just download and start doing your research. You don't have to kind of made your research material by yourself. And there's for newspapers and magazines, there's materials from 1970 and so on. And what these packages are including, they have a page of metadata that is also kind of comments or something else that actually information that is kind of extra for the data itself. And there's also kind of a structural analysis already within. But there's a kind of it's not totally free to use. And if you want to use those already made packages, you kind of have to ask for them, and then you have to also explain why do you need it and what kind of research you are doing. That is a kind of a process you have to go through, but it's quite easy nowadays. So here's the kind of link where you can actually find these data packages, and then there's also the other link where you can find some customized packages already. And sometimes it's just interesting just go and browse them and see what's there. I gonna Tanya open a little bit this data mining from the web.
Yes, sorry, my mouse was stuck. I couldn't open my mic at first, but yes. So we will not be going deep into this on this course, but I think it's important that you know that there is the possibility of downloading data directly from different websites, and how it's used, we're usually talking about scraping websites or web scraper, but some services actually offer pre-built interfaces. So, for example, there's the Twitter API for academic research. Currently, I am actually not quite sure on what is the situation with the research API, since we all know that Twitter, or X, as it's usually currently calls itself, has gone through many, many changes. But this is like a common common thing to find that there's an API, which is something, it's kind of this interface that's often meant, for example, developers who want to create something in connect that connects to a particular, for example, social media service or other website. So, and this is something that researchers can use as well for collecting the data. So usually this collection demands some technical skills, but not how would I say, not in as much as that you should study computer sciences for 5 years before you are able to do it. So it is something that can be learned, but of course it's something that also you can ask for help for. So just kind of remember that this option is available. There are also some tools developed by research facilities, researchers for this purpose. So for mining data from a particular service, for example, this is something that for the last couple of years, I've worked in a project where we have actually built this kind of data collector for Twitch service, so a video streaming service. So these kinds of projects are popping up all around the world currently.
At least your mouse is manageable, but my cats are fighting next to me, so hopefully they're not distracting me too much. So the management of the digital material, that is quite big, kind of important issue, and it's usually the life cycle of your data is larger than you might like first think about it. So it usually starts when you start creating the data, and then you have to already think many different things that involves of making notes or making data, and how you protect the data, and where you're gonna keep it, or how you're gonna share it, or how you're gonna store it, because there's lots of regulations that you have to kind of think about it. And usually this data management, it's more like a when it's a bigger research project, but if you're like doing your PhD studies, then it's much more easier for you, and so you get a little bit easier. But then there's some things that you have to take care of, and also university has a really good guidelines that what you can check, so that if you have done everything what you need to be done.
Yes, and the larger the data set gets, the more questions or challenges there are, of course. So if you have particularly large data sets, it can be a challenge to just figure out how to transfer the data, where to store it, how to use it, so that it's secure, so that it's still usable and convenient to use for research. So, personal experience, for example, from the last couple of years was that we spent in a project, we spent around 8 to 9 months figuring out together with the archive and the data holder how to transfer data so that it's so that everybody is okay with the procedure. So, oftentimes, the more modern data in archives, even though it's stored in archives, it's not necessarily owned by the archives. So there can be a different owner. And in this case that I'm talking about, we were using data that was owned by a government entity, so a ministry. So there we had to kind of discuss and find a solution with among these three different actors on how to transfer large quantities of data that includes personal information, so somewhat sensitive information as well. In that project and in many others, the place where you can get help as well is CSC. So it's the Center for Scientific Computing in Finland that offers services to researchers for this particular purpose. And they have different solutions for different types of data. So if you have sensitive data, they have different services in relation to if you have more conventional data sets. CSC services might become especially necessary if you have huge data sets of visual or video, image or video data. That specifically is when the storage capabilities locally become, e easily not enough. But they give great guidance on these topics as well. So there are possibilities. But should we go on to the practical part of our lecture?
Yes, and even there's a lots of stuff you can also do it by yourself. So like we have a huge processes and mass digitalization, sometimes you just realize that what you would like to do and your research material is something like some in text form, but it's never going to be digitalized in any institution or organization. Then you have to do it by yourself, and it's quite easy to do from printed material. And most commonly, these printed materials are from like from books or so on. So how you gonna do it? It's first you have to scan it for yourself, and you can use university scanners and printers, and you just choose a scanning option, and then you have just to check that the best results you get if you just scan and save it in a TIFF format, which is image. And then I will show you the API Fine Reader program, how you can use that by turning that image like in a text form, a digital text form for you. And what is the good about this TIFF file is that it gives you only one file, even you have a scan like 10 pages or 20 pages. So it's easy to work. So I have been using this API Fine Reader. This is also a program what the national libraries have been using, so it's quite stable. And but it's also a program that costs, and there's a if you want to test it, there's a 7-day free trial. So after this lecture, you can my you want probably if you want to test it, you just first think something that you want to scan and put it in a TIFF form, and then you just go to API Fine Reader webpage and download that free trial version, and then you just test it and see what you can get. But it looks like this. And this is how it actually looks like if you have a scanned some text. I have this old Swedish written letters that I have scanned for myself, and I will soon show you how you actually do it, but this is how it looks like. It's like in this left panel here, you can kind of see all the pages that you have opened in this. And then it gives you two kind of boxes where the program shows that what area the program has scanned. And also in the right hand side, you can see how it has read it. So you can kind of check it there, like, is there any mistakes? And you can correct them. You can kind of go through them, correct them. And in the end, you can save it for example, Microsoft Word document. So it kind of transforms your text from these scanned images to text form. And usually it's best to use like a plain text form. So it gives you a best solution. But when I use this old Swedish, it gives a little bit kind of some difficulties. So I have to kind of clean the data. So usually they are quite good. So it depends on the little bit how the scanning was. The better quality the scanning is, the better quality you get from the text. And sometimes if it's like really old books, there's a little bit kind of smooshy the text. It might makes a little bit more errors, but you can kind of go it through and clean it a little bit. So there's a question like how much you need to clean it. So if you look at that, it's mostly okay. So, and if you're looking for the bigger picture and kind of maybe teams or something like that, you don't kind of, so you are not so detail oriented, then you don't have to make it so clean. You can kind of search different themes and so on. So when you actually have it in this form, this is a really good question you have to ask for yourself, how necessary it is to clean up the data in the end. But if you are looking for some language structures and some kind of how the really detailed stuff, then of course, the more cleaner you have to make the data. So here's like an example, what the printed text have been in the left side, and this is the digitalized form what I've been when after I have used transferred it in a Word documents. I will now stop sharing this, and I will actually open the program itself. It looks like this. And this is the what you need to use. Open the OCR editor. So if I scanned some pages from the book from the library, and now I will show you how you can do it in this. You open. And here you can see it's in this TIFF form. I just open that. Now, okay, hopefully everybody can see. Now the program is scanning through the pages from the TIFF images. And the program kind of recognized that if you have scanned like the book open so that there's like two pages in one scan, then the program kind of understands and separates them and puts them in like different pages. And now, okay, there's a 55 pages the program has now recognized. So in this left column, you can see the scanning program. And this is the right shows that what it looks like after. So if these are pages that we don't need, you can also delete it. Let's just. And this is, let's put it a little bit bigger. For example, if the scanned area, there's a text like what you don't need, like here, it has scanned also page number and also this kind of small side information. You can remove these by delete so that it doesn't come to and mess your document in the end like this. And let's move forward. But then like in this page we have the page number included here, but so if you scan like this and transform it in your digital form, you get the page number here, and sometimes it goes inside the text, so it kind of a little bit messes your stuff. So you can move it outside. But if you do this, then you have to kind of re-scan it, and it's right click from your mouse, and you just recognize it again. And so now you can see from the right column that the number has now disappeared. So then you just go and do whatever you want to do for all the pages. And then if you want to that text in your digital form, you just click here and just choose. There's a different kind of options, but to save as a Microsoft Word document, you just click it. Just find the place where you want to save it, and it already keeps you in a docs. And I will show you the Microsoft Word document. And here's how it looks like when it's transformed in a Microsoft Word document. Sometimes you have to, usually I do also that I copy all and then I kind of open the new Microsoft Word document and then I just attach the text as a plain text so that it doesn't have any formations at all. So that's how you can create your old thing for yourself. So now you can go in and find yourself some materials you own, what you want to attach or no, make yourself a digital form material, and you can maybe in a demo session in Monday.
Yes, Monday.
Monday, we can kind of share experiences, like at was it easily to do, or did you have any difficulties? And also, that if you think that there would be a need for yourself, that you would like to maybe make a little bit bigger corpus for yourself, then in our faculty we have this one laptop we have been like a we have a license, so that you can contact me and I can help you with them.
So there is Abby software on that computer
Yes.
that's not a trial version but an actual bought official version. So the download link that's in Moodle, and I also added in the chat. Remember, you for free only get the 7-day trial version, but you get the idea of what it's like to use. I think, Marco, perhaps next Monday's session. So, also remember, everyone, you usually have meetings on Wednesdays and Thursdays. So, lecture on Wednesday, demo on Thursday. But this week is an exception because tomorrow is the Jyväskylä Business Network Day. What was it called? Jyväskylä University Business Network Day. And I think me and Marco are both attached with that. And maybe some of you others are there as well. So, that is why. This week, the demonstration is on Monday. So there's the in the course schedule, you can see all the exceptions. There's also one other exception later on in the course schedule. But I think would that be a nice time also for possible questions if you have with other types of data digitization. Maybe we have time to answer those kind of questions as well, do you think?
Yes.
So even if you yourself don't have exactly this type of need currently, you are free to come and ask about other types of digitalization as well. So we will either give you an answer or direct you to an expert or a person at the university to help you with that. But next week lecture's topic is annotation. So we will look at how to do coding and annotation using a digital software that's made for that purpose. So we're looking at Atlas T and Atlas TI and Katma, this free browser-based option. And you do not need to buy Atlas TI if you don't have it. If you have a university computer, you could download it and install it on that. So if you haven't done that, it might be a good idea to do that beforehand. But if you are only using your personal computer and do not have the need to get Atlas TI, you are still good to go for next lecture and next week's lecture and the demonstration after that. There are free options. But I think that's all for now. Do we have other current issues we need to talk about, Marco?
No, I don't think so.
Or does anyone have
Question?
questions? If not, thank you, everyone. And we will see you next week, and we'll put up the materials in Moodle.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Ok, kiitoksia.
Yeah. You can stop recording.